Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 141 of the Bugle for the week beginning Monday, the 24th of January, 2011, with me, Andy Zaltzman, in London, and in New York City, it's the self-proclaimed Marlena Dietrich of men's table tennis, John Oliver.
Yes, Andy, I regret nothing of my forehand smashes across the ping pong table. Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy, I just got back from Texas, you know, the spiritual home of John Oliver. It's where, you know, I feel naturally at home.
Yep.
Just working the land.
Yep. Did you dig for oil?
I did, a bit while I was there. You know, I am an oil man.
That's right.
I had some phenomenal barbecue, Andy. I went to Good Company Barbecue in Houston, Texas. Right. And I tell you what, it is really laying down a challenge to vegetarians and Hindus worldwide. Oh, really? You don't think cows should be eaten? Are you sure about that? Because your taste buds seem to be doing an impromptu impression of a cascading waterfall right now. All I know is this, Andy. If I was a cow and I knew I could taste like that, I find it very hard to make a coherent case for not being immediately killed and slow-cooked.
So 141, coincidentally, the number of mice Barack Obama killed in the White House last week after he got sick of the Animal Rights Brigade preventing him dealing with the infestation that dates back to one of Gerald Ford's notorious cheddar crumbling parties. And this is the week beginning 24th of January, meaning it's 55 years since Arthur Miller broke the All-America belching record. 23.4 seconds. He collapsed and nearly died afterwards. Spent 2 weeks on a drip with 3 broken ribs, but survived. And won Marilyn Monroe as a prize. Literally a trophy wife. She was pretty cross with her agent for having put her up as the prize for the Flatulent Playwrights of America competition. But she had to be impressed with Miller's winning time, which easily outdid Tennessee Williams' rather pitiful 12.7 seconds, and Thornton Wilder's silver medal winning 18.9. Also the first ever Bugle in which I can claim that I totally sold out a venue. So thank you to all those Buglers who came to the Soho Theatre and presented me with far fewer empty seats than I'm used to. It was a bit disorientating, to be honest. I don't know what I was doing. As always, some of the Bugle is going straight in the bin. This week's Sex in the Bin is a films section, and it's sequel season. We review some of the top sequels coming into the cinema soon, including There May Be Yogurt, Paul Thomas Anderson's disappointingly mundane follow-up to his multi-award-winning 2007 hit There Will Be Blood. Set in an old people's home, There May Be Yogurt follows elderly patients Julius and Hargreave as they discuss what they're likely to be served for their meals and wait for the eventual release of death. Lacking the epic scope and emotional intensity of There Will Be Blood, not to mention its cinematic ambition, There May Be Yogurt fails to provide much to engage the under-75 demographic and is further undermined by the disastrous miscasting of Meatloaf as the seductive head nurse. And also we review Tony Tomato and the Potato Processing Plant. An unexpected animated follow-up to Gone with the Wind took 7 years to get the funding in place, and it's a very odd mixture of child-oriented animation and unrelenting swearing. That section, in the bin.
Top story this week. Hands up, everyone who's got a government. Put your hand down, Tunisia. Now, after we focused on the wobbliness of Sudan last week, Tunisia almost immediately responded by seeing Sudan's wobbliness and raising them some Richter-scale shakiness. The condensed version of what happened in Tunisia in the last week is that President Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali ruled Tunisia for 22 years and now he's gone. He's not dead, he's just gone. One second he was there, the next second, before you could say, where the f*** is President Ben Ali, he was in a plane leaving Tunisian airspace screaming, see you later, losers. I should mention that that is both a condensed and a partly fictionalised version of last week's events. Now, President Ben Ali came to power 22 years ago through a military coup, and he's basically going out with one as well, and that's how it should be. It's the natural life cycle of a dictator. It's the kind of sequence of events that should be covered by David Attenborough, laying down very still on the steps in front of the president's palace, saying, in a dance as old as time, we see the president has lost the confidence of the country's military leaders. And after a few distinctive cries for help, there's one now, there's another. He will take flight and migrate to a safer climate. As often as this has happened throughout humanity's time on Earth, one still feels humbled and privileged to witness this spectacular migration in the flesh.
Oh, my God, he's humping another dictator. Let's edit that bit out. Well, the international reaction, John, was one of strong condemnation of the Ben Ali government, which had been in power since 1987, and which had not exactly been batting off international condemnation like a pesky wasp at a picnic. But the international community did make a strong and principled stand against him in his final 20 minutes in power, once it became clear that he was toast. He was pretty much standing around waiting for his helicopter, saying to the international community, enough already, I'm having a bad day as it is without you losers giving me shit. It was all a bit reminiscent when England won the Rugby World Cup, John, in 2003, and all of a sudden, in between Johnny Wilkinson kicking the winning drop goal and the end of the game 30 seconds later, 5 million people applied for English citizenship, just so they could go on the bus parade and feel good about themselves for a bit.
The scale of these developments took almost everyone by surprise. Until recently, Tunisia was a popular tourist destination and had been seen as a haven of stability and relative prosperity, albeit a haven that was watched over by a president who was no stranger to ordering a violent crackdown. You know, just to keep those beaches nice and clean of rubbish or political dissenters. So how did this dramatic turn of events come about? Well, on December the 17th, a young unemployed man named Mohamed Bouzami set fire to himself when officials in his town prevented him from selling vegetables on the streets of Sidi Bouzid without permission. This tragedy set off protests about jobs in the town, which has an agricultural-based economy, one of the poorest regions of the country. The authorities responded violently to these protests, with the police opening fire on demonstrators, sparking protests across the country. So far, so funny, Andy. After the death of what the government estimates is 78 protesters and the loss of support among military leaders, President Ben Ali decided to make like a tree and get the fuck out of Tunisia as fast as he could. On the 14th of January, he announced that he was stepping down temporarily before grabbing his family and heading straight for the airport. And the drama didn't stop there. France reportedly rejected a request for his plane to land there, so he went to Saudi Arabia instead. But apparently, some of the president's relatives had already arrived in Paris and were holed up in a luxury hotel at Euro Disney. Was that where he was planning to go, Andy? Euro Disney? Because if so, I think he needs better PR representation. Because when your country is rioting over high unemployment, rising food prices, and systematic corruption further widening the gigantic poverty gap, what better way to calm your people down than having your photo taken with Daffy Duck?
Well, it just means that he can go incognito, can't he? He could just get himself a nice quiet job as someone dressed as Goofy. And, you know, just live out his days in peace. You know, if only Ceausescu had had that option, John. I mean, he had the suit already, just he didn't have time to put it on. Well, I mean, that would have made a more interesting video. But the British reaction, the British media's reaction was fascinating. The only angle they could really get on it was it affecting British holidaymakers.
Yeah.
And this was the most important aspect of the story. So we are now joined by our North Africa correspondent, Jeff Spag. Jeff, people of Tunisia have harnessed the power of the internet to overcome a violently oppressive regime in a landmark revolution that potentially marks an irreversible sea change in mass democracy worldwide as people come together to rise up against injustice, corruption and brutality, potentially sparking similar revolutions as the disenfranchised masses of the world surf a riptide of freedom. Well, let's get to the nub of this, Jeff. Tell us. How is this affecting British tourists? They must have been really pissed off, Jeff, having their sunbathing interrupted by a revolution and stuff. Hang on to that, Jeff. We have now to go live to our Sudan correspondent, Honketa Paduki, with news on how the historic independence referendum in South Sudan could open a new range of adventure vacation options for British holidaymakers.
I don't know why it was such a surprise to his or any other country that he fled, because there were reports that President Ben Ali's wife personally went into the central bank in Tunisia looking to withdraw 1.5 tons of gold bullion.
So Gordon Brown's wife did the same in May here last year.
Did the they really think that there was any chance that they were not heading straight for the airport and going straight to the nothing to declare line? Because that is not suspicious at all, is it? The wife of the president, whose administration seems to be teetering on the brink of collapse, wandering in and saying, I was just passing by, and I wondered if, by any chance, you had $32 million worth of gold bars hanging around. I was thinking of buying a clock.
Yeah, but the problem with that is, you know, you try and take that on a plane and instantly you're hit with about $31 million worth of extra baggage fines. So, I mean, is it worth it?
You've got to hand it to President Benalino. That was an impressive disappearing act. He took his country and the entire international community by surprise. He's like a dictatorial David Copperfield, vanishing from a country, taking 1.5 tons of gold bars with him as well. I do hope that when the bank staff opened the vaults to check on the bullion, there was just a white tiger in there and a woman in a sparkly bikini.
But just goes to show, John, Sir Peopleton, as you've shown, and as all nagging children know, if you complain long enough and loud enough, eventually the authorities will give up and leave the country. And just the same with parents, really. And I think it's very interesting, John, that Tunisia was quite a repressive country. The press freedom organisation Reporters Without Borders had Tunisia 164th out of 178 countries in its press freedom index, and listed Tunisia as one of 15 enemies of the internet, saying it had an effective system of censoring. And yet still, they managed to sort of harness the power of the internet to coordinate this sort of informal revolution that sort of sprung out of nothing. And this is a potentially momentous event. I mean, the genie is out of the bottle, John, and having spent so much time in the bottle, that genie is angry, hammered, and he needs a piss. Of course, the only... it's amazing what you can do online now. Everything. You can find a spouse without having to go through the inconvenience of meeting one. You can buy socks without anyone else knowing. Mm-hmm. You can watch rhinoceroses snowboarding. You can call someone who supports another football team that you don't like a f-headed f-horse who's kind of a mother f-s pigs for money. Without the threat of them instantly beating you to death with a fire extinguisher, hasn't football moved on in the internet age? And now it turns out that you can even overthrow corrupt regimes. Now, with hindsight, John, and bear in mind, as we speak, Tony Blair has just finished his latest stint in front of the Iraq Inquiry, his 2011 comeback special, dressed in black leather and churning out the same old classic hits. Sorry, hits is an anagram there. Let's see if you can work it out. Basically, Blair was bullshitting like a brave but greedy matador the day after a spectacularly successful fight. But in hindsight, in Iraq, John, would it not have been at least worth a go, instead of going in all in with Johnny Bang Bang, or the armed forces, as the government like to call them, would it not have been worth a shot to just airdrop a load of modems, BlackBerries, and instructions on how to set up a Twitter feed? But it seemed to work. I know Twitter didn't crap its way onto humanity until 2006, but the point stands, John.
That was the only problem, Andy. That was the only problem. But the bombs were the only alternative at that point.
Of course, all most people know about Tunisia, John, before this, was that England beat them 2-0 in their opening game of the 1998 World Cup with goals by Shearer and Scholes. But it actually goes back further than 1998. It's the site of the ancient city of Carthage, from where the military strategy whiz Hannibal came. He famously took an army of elephants across the Alps. People said he did this because he was an incredibly daring general who found solutions to any problem facing him. In reality, he just wanted to see what an elephant would look like on skis. The answer, angry. Funny, but angry.
Lithuania news now. And Andy, when you think of Lithuania, what do you think of?
Well,
that's right.
I'll tell you that. I'll tell you what I think of when I think of Lithuania. Yep. I think of my grandfather running away from the Lithuanian army due to the institutionalised anti-Semitism there in the early part of the 20th century.
That's interesting, Andy, because...
The rest of my family never really wanting to talk about it after the devastation that engulfed those of them who stayed there during the Second World War.
OK. I mean, to everyone else, it just means nothing, Andy. Your mind instantly goes blank. Trying to think of something, anything that has to do with Lithuania.
All right, I just instantly think of the greatest slaughter of humanity in the history of our species.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I guess now maybe I'll think of running Zaltzmans across the mountain.
Yeah.
In fact, it's a well-known Buddhist technique to clear the mind of all thought by trying to get someone to think of something to do with Lithuania. Do they eat ham? I mean, they can probably take a punch from the Russians. Do they play those wooden panpipe flutes? Ah, shit, no, that's Peruvians.
Do they collaborate over-enthusiastically with the Germans during the war? Do they?
Who'd have thought?
Oh, it was ages ago.
Lithuania would be such a hot button issue for
it
you.
It was ages ago.
Well, Lithuania's lack of distinguishing features is no longer going to be an issue, because the government there has announced the release of a new national scent, a perfume and an aftershave. They claim that the scent is a good example of how to communicate Lithuania to the public in an innovative way. What a great idea, Andy. The perfume is apparently a blend of sandalwood, cedar and musk, with the designer saying that the smell of wood fires has been added, reminiscent of pagan rituals. Sounds sexy, Andy. Sounds like a perfume that makes you want to bang. And not just bang, but bang the nation of Lithuania. Yeah. I know it would be kind of a hate-filled bang for you after what we've just learnt, but still, a bang nonetheless. I presume that that's what they were going for. Lithuania's foreign ministry has already sent bottles of the new fragrance to all ambassadors, credit to Vilnius, and also Lithuanian soldiers in Afghanistan have received the perfume. I'm sure that's going to be of great use to them, Andy. At least they know what smell they're fighting for now. It's a great motivator when you're involved in fighting an intractable war.
So they didn't go with the smell of gefilte fish and gunshot.
No, they went a different way. It's going to be rolled out to all Lithuanian embassies, hotels and airports, and also scented candles will go on sale next month. But here's the thing. They need to understand that the key ingredient to a perfume's success nowadays is not the perfume itself, it is the marketing involved. Now, for a start, the perfume's going to be called Lithuania. Good idea. Keep it simple. You got a strong brand recognition there. Unfortunately, you don't have any famous Lithuanians to endorse it. I mean, well, obviously there's Birute Galdikas, the orangutan specialist and writer, but they have to shell out millions to get his endorsement. Monica Lewinsky is of Lithuanian descent, but I'm not sure they want to run a campaign based around her spraying the perfume on one of her blue dresses. They could have legendary gold medal-winning discus thrower Virgilius Alenka throwing the bottle 73.88 metres, the Lithuanian national discus record. That might be effective. But more than that, what kind of bottle do you put it in? Maybe something in the shape of Lithuania, but the shape of Lithuania with a pair of boobs on the front. You have to make it sexy. And
I'm of Lithuanian origin, John. I can do it.
Well, that's true. I didn't even think of that. All this should culminate in a series of pretentious black and white commercials selling Lithuania not as a perfume, not as a country, but as an entire lifestyle choice.
Dance. Love. Be. Sniff. Lithuania. Parfum. Put on. Et pour anyone that wants to smell like a damp forest. Because with an annual rainfall of 722 millimetres, this country is wet. Parce que dans Lithuania, il pleut.
It'll be flying off the shelves, Andy. Next thing you know, James Bond will be sidling up to someone in a cocktail dress in his next movie saying, "Are you wearing Lithuania? Because I've always wanted to have sexual intercourse with a 25,000 square mile landmass that has a curvy 90 kilometres of coastline." Why would we stop here? All countries should have their own scent. Britain's would be a combination of beer, urine, vomit and mould. America's would sort of hamburgers, cheese, eagles and tears. In fact, I think we should have a bugle scent, Andy. A delicate combination of a splash of Silvio Berlusconi sweat and 14.2 tonnes of genuine bullshit.
Listen. Feel. Know. Desire. When facts are not enough, speculate. Bugle, pour femme, pour homme, et pour les enfants. Squirt it in your ears.
Too soon, John. Too soon.
Novelty tie news now. And, well, Andy, there's a time and a place for the novelty tie. The place is around the neck of an uncle at a bar mitzvah, and the time is absolutely never. Now, there are fewer and fewer high-profile sightings of the novelty tie until this last week in England, because a Conservative MP, Nadeem Zahawi, had to apologise to the Speaker of the House of Commons after inadvertently turning on his musical tie. What? while delivering a speech during a debate on education funding. It started playing a tinny tune while he was talking, and as colleagues and opponents looked around the chamber for the source, he realised what had happened and said, "I apologise, it's my tie to support the campaign against bowel cancer that was making that noise. It is a musical tie." What a phenomenal moment for democracy, Andy. There is no way to turn off a musical tie with any dignity. It's impossible. And it undercuts everything that you're about to say. If only Hitler had a musical tie during one of his speeches at Nuremberg, it would have successfully undercut all of his mad ravings about the evil of the Jews. Oh, look, the idiot's wearing a musical tie. Oh, let's all just get along.
Well, it's just Abraham Lincoln used to wear musical ties, and in fact, his went off just as he was starting the Gettysburg Address. But of course, there was no YouTube then, yep. So you know, he got away with it. Different times.
I couldn't make out what tune the tie was playing. I think it might have been "Have You Seen Her" by MC Hammer, but I don't know why that would be the case. Yeah,
I think it might have been "You Give Love a Bad Name."
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah, but he did apologise, as you said. He apologised to the speaker, but he apologised in the manner of a man who knew he had to apologise, but at the same time was struggling to contain the words, "Roger, you owe me 50 quid, sucker."
It was like he was about to say, "I will apologise, but I am not sorry."
It was quality effort. The only thing that could possibly trump it, John, is Westminster Abbey, 29th of April. Do you, Prince William, take this woman... I knew I should have written on my hand. Kate. Okay. Do you, Prince William, take Kate to be your lawful wedded wife? I do. Good, oh, that's made my job a lot easier. I now pronounce you... Hang on, I'll just switch this on. Man and wife. I want to be buried in a musical tie, John. F***ing loud one.
Wish granted, Andy.
Thanks. Most reports of ghosts actually turn out to be people who've been buried wearing novelty musical ties. You know. I actually did once own a musical tie. Oh, no, hang on, that's not right. No, I once wrapped Yehudi Menuhin around my neck. That's a big, big difference.
Well, it's basically the same.
But they're basically, the musical tie is basically the multifunctional forerunner of today's smartphones. Because I know for a fact that Steve Jobs was given a musical tie for his 18th birthday. And he thought, wow, I've always been brought up to think that one thing does one thing and one thing only. And now this, a very smart necktie that also plays the tune of "Hitler Has Only Got One Ball." I wonder what other seemingly non-compatible devices could work together. Maybe the sausage dog, the typewritercle, and the iPhone. That's the one, the iPhone, a prosthetic eye that replaces your natural eyeball but can also be used as a telephone. Yeah, you'd have to plug your face in, of course, but this has got potential. Now, of course, it took him a while to get there, and yes, there were key modifications along the way, but that musical tie set in motion the chain of events that produced the world's top-selling fashion accessory, the iPhone.
Royal wedding update now! Well, it's getting closer and closer, Andy.
It sure is, yep.
I hope everyone has their royal wedding countdown advent calendars. Every day, I open a little window to see a picture of the Queen with a speech bubble saying, "Hello! It's not yet, I'm afraid, but here, have a lovely chocolate." And there's a tasty chocolate there in the shape of Westminster Abbey, or a corgi, or a footman, or a crown, or a Prince Albert. It's a treat every day. Now, obviously, we're going to be updating you with all the developments running up to the wedding day, during the wedding day, and for the years after the wedding day.
Yeah, we are, of course, the official podcast of the royal wedding.
That is unofficially true. This promises to be the greatest union between two people in the history of the planet Earth, Andy. And the latest news is that Prince William and the soon-to-be Queen Kate, goddess of all earthly things, are considering foregoing gifts from guests in favour of charity donations. What a sweet, touching, truly heartfelt PR exercise this is, Andy. Obviously, it could be a very profitable idea for some extremely worthwhile causes. And it's also extremely generous, considering the kind of bounty they could have walked away with. The Queen and Prince Philip were given a racehorse as a wedding present. Sadly, it was a dead racehorse, as Prince Philip shook the box vigorously around to try and guess what it was, then shot the box with a rifle to try and get a clue of what the gift sounded like when it was shot. When Prince Charles and Lady Diana married, they received more than 6,000 gifts, including a piece of crocheted lace made from yarn personally spun by Mahatma Gandhi. Ouch, Andy. I would not want to be next in line to give them a gift after they unwrap that one. Wow. Lace made from yarn spun by Gandhi's own hand. That is beautiful. I got you a juicer.
A juicer modelled on the testicles of Nelson Mandela.
They also received a solid gold model of an Arab sailing dhow, encrusted with gems from the Emir of Bahrain that was thought to be worth around £1 million, plus an extremely expensive sapphire pendant by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And what William and Kate might want to do is say, please, everyone, don't get us gifts. Please instead donate to one of the charities that are most important to us as a couple. Except for you, Saudi Arabia. You should really go all out on the gift front. Maybe a diamond model of a jet ski or something. I'll leave it up to you.
Well, of course, you know, you say it's very noble of them not to want wedding gifts. But, I mean, realistically, you know, a popular young couple, 60 million people in Britain, they are not going to want 60 million identical napkins, are they? But the way I look at it, John, is to say, f*** them, they're getting a mid-range saucepan, and that is the end of it. And I'm also going to leave a large marrow in the hotel room on their wedding night. which is what our friend Danny Boy did for me and my wife on our wedding night. A large marrow in a plastic bag.
Right from the heart, Andy.
On our beds. Right on the wedding night. And, you know, I guess she had a basic sort of fertility angle. Well, the problem is my wife loves cooking, and you know, she just spent the whole evening making soup.
He talked about it with all of us, and he said, you know, it's so hard to know what to get them. How about a marrow? And we all said, well, that's perfect, Danny. That's perfect, and I wish I'd thought of it. Do you want me to go halves on that marrow? And he said, no, I just want it to be from me. And I said, I understand.
Yep.
It's a lovely gift.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah. Your emails now, and thanks again for your emails. I would say that in response to one email we got from Steve O'Gallagher, we will not accept any requests to tell friends of Buglers to go f*** themselves. Not even Steve O'Gallagher's housemate Adam Pollard, who wanted us to tell to go f*** himself. I'm afraid we're not taking that we cannot uncork that magnum of pain.
That's very... It's a very dangerous precedent to set, Andy. Andy is not going to become a go-f-self jukebox for hire.
Well, John will continue advertising Texan barbecue houses.
Yes, I will. Honestly, good country barbecue. Unbelievably good. Was it good country? What was it? I don't actually know. What was it? Good company barbecue.
Right.
Do yourself a favour.
Yeah.
And have the brisket there. Ridiculous brisket. Ridiculous.
Yeah. I'm going to put in a word for Imperial Teas of Lincoln.
Fine. Yeah.
Got a class A habit now. Bad.
There's another email here from Isabel who says, she says, hey, John, Andy and Chris, as a Belgian bugler... Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Uh-oh.
Well, we're going
to... just flashing
back. Are we about to be hauled across the coals? Or hauled across the waffles?
Do something else! as a Belgian bugler, I felt like I couldn't let this one slide. Just a short list of the things that make Belgium great, apart from waffles. Okay.
It's going to be very short, presumably.
Yeah. Belgian beers, she says. Not the brown tap water you guys drink, but the... Heavenly Trappist Ales and Abbey Beers.
Yeah, someone else made them first.
Yep. Belgian chocolates.
Ditto.
Yeah, and also that's really tied to the waffle anyway. French fries. She said, yeah, we invented those, and yes, I know they're not called Belgian fries, but we were going for alliteration, okay? Bullshit.
Yeah, bullshit. And anyway, what bullshit. Is a waffle apart from a load of fries just laid in a kind of lattice pattern, essentially?
Belgian tennis players. You might have heard of Justine Henin and
basically
Kim Clijsters.
Basically German.
Georges Lemaître, the guy who discovered the origin of the universe.
Yeah, bollocks, it was written in the Bible. It's there, it's public domain.
There you go. Audrey Hepburn, bet you didn't know she was Belgian.
That's because she wasn't, she was British.
Herman von Rompuy, President of the European Union. It isn't because you guys try to ignore it that it doesn't exist.
No, you can have him. You can have him. You can have von Rompuy.
Okay, that's one. Jacques Rogge, President of the International Olympic Committee, and thus solely responsible for bringing the Games to London.
Oh, big whoop. Big whoop. We've got Seb Coe. He could actually run as well.
Hergé, who wrote The Adventures of Tintin.
Boring!
And Jean-Claude Van Damme, the muscles from Brussels.
Oh, fair point. Fair point.
Okay, so you got two there.
Van Damme.
I rest my case, he says. Belgium rules, even though technically nobody rules Belgium for the time being. They're probably too busy eating waffles. That's right, Isabel. Even you, as a Belgian, cannot resist a Belgian waffle joke. She says, but anyway, thanks for saving our ass when Hitler did the whole Hitler thing. That is the nicest way of describing the start of the Second World War, when Hitler did the whole Hitler thing.
Yeah, do you know the only Belgian means of defence, because obviously, you know, couldn't cope to compete with Germany militarily, so they just tried to feed all the German soldiers loads of waffles, so they just got kind of bloated and sleepy.
Yeah.
That's really the only string to their bow. So what else could they do? I've been pulled up on a couple of factual errors in the last Bugle. Bugle 140.
Is that really something people want to start doing?
Well, this one comes from Shane Dunn, who writes, Dear BBC, the Bugle, I was disgusted to hear the latest edition of the Bugle in which a certain Andrew Zaltzman stated that episode 140 was, and I quote, the last ever Bugle whose numbers you could score at darts without hitting three trebles or a combination of trebles and bullseyes. What about doubles, Mr. Zaltzman? I clearly meant without hitting trebles and then a double. Everyone knows you can't check out without a double or a bull. It was clearly just a slip of the tongue. It wasn't a factual error.
Wow. He touched a nerve there, Andy.
I wait to hear this being used in its correct form in episode 160. Two treble 20s and a double 20. Yeah, I know that. You, sir, what I was saying is basically the last time you can check out with an error. Does that make it clearer? You, sir, are not fit to be called a professional darts counting episode numbering expert, continues Shane, which of course you aren't, but the point still stands. So, I hope I've cleared that one up. And this one also comes in from signed Benoit Waffle and Ophira McDoom on the subject. I call bullshit. Dear Mr. Zaltzman, regarding your fact box involving the Washington Wizards baseball team, you should know there is no such thing. The Washington Wizards are a basketball team.
True. I remember you making that mistake and I let it go, Andy.
The rest of the fact box appears to be spot on. Well, I know it's a basketball team. It was clearly another slip of the tongue. I was very tired last week. And, you know, I do my research for these things. I don't just sit there and make shit up. Thank you, Mr. Waffle and Miss McDoom.
Maybe it was the case last week, but the Wizards did a spell and have changed everyone's preconception of what a wizard, the Washington Wizards, are.
Yep.
Could be.
In your defence.
I've got to tell you, Benoit Waffle is an incredible name. That's lasted a week. Still like that.
Benny Waffle. Can we now officially call anyone from Belgium Benny Waffle?
I think little Benny Waffle.
Little Benny Waffle going down the wing there. The young lad from Bruges. And thanks also to Will, who sent in a very entertaining story that we'll talk about next week about the latest in the India v Pakistan rivalry. So do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Sport now, and the New York Cosmos is back!
Yes!
The greatest team in the history of football in America. That used to have Pele as a player. That basically makes it the greatest team in the history of football in America. Are back. They have a management team. They have Pele as honorary president. And the French and Manchester United legend Eric Cantona has just been appointed director of football.
Yeah.
All they don't currently have is players in a team. And a stadium. And this raises the old philosophical question, John. When is a football club not a football club?
Yeah.
And do they count? Just because they don't have players, does that mean they're not a football club? I mean, why be so prescriptive? I'm a professional tennis player. That is my job. work is scarce. I've only played tennis about twice in 10 years, but I accept any commissions that I consider suitable for Andy Zaltzman. So am I a professional tennis player or not? And I'll respond to that. Yeah. And if you say no,
he's just
let me live my own life.
Well, Cantona described his job as saying it's kind of a mix between football and art. That sounds good, Andy. He's going to provide the team with tactics, but it will be through abstract painting. The team will have to decipher what he means by each brushstroke. It also gives him the perfect excuse when things go badly. Because if the Cosmos lose, it's not a defeat, Andy. It's an installation on the concept of not winning. The Cosmos were, as you say, famous for bringing over the greatest players of the day, Pelé and Beckenbauer. But if they really want to fill the stadium, just bring back Pelé to play. He's clearly still alive. And I personally would... I would definitely buy a season ticket if it meant that every weekend I could turn up and watch old man Pelé run around. Cantona says his new club aims to play at the highest level. Oh, all right, so they won't be playing in America then. I guess he's hoping that they get promoted somehow to play in the Primera División in Spain.
It might mean that he's just going to take him on a pre-season tour of Paraguay. Play at altitude.
Pretty high.
Always big advantage for the home team there. Big advantage. So that's about it for this week, Buglers. Thank you for listening. We cannot thank you enough. So we will not thank you enough. We'll be back next week with more. That's all I have to say. Bye-bye.
Muchas gracias, Buglers. Arrivederci!